If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and manipulation from two rays of sunshine who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc, Ray of Sunshine.
And I am Megan Elizabeth, Ray of Sunshine, I guess. Let's go with it.
I mean, you are to me.
No one has called me a Ray of Sunshine in the past year, I don't think. But that's okay.
Listen, you sometimes rain also, but why Ray of Sunshine doesn't rain? You know what I'm saying? That's just science.
Oh, so true.
Today, our guest is Sari Crawford. She is the host of the podcast The Sunshine Place, which covers Synanon, a notorious drug rehabilitation program turned cult that was active from the 50s through the 70s, which we also covered in our episode with Mikkel Jolet from the Airborne Toxic event. You can go ahead and listen to that episode if you want to hear his story. But for now, Sari is going to tell us about how her own father was a musician who was an early member of Synanon and held a leadership position. She'll walk us through the history of the group, how it was started by a man named Charles Dietrich, or Chuck, and originally actually did a lot of good until it didn't. And we'll talk about what some of the practices were, including something called The Game, which involved disclosing one's personal traumas in front of the group.
We'll also discuss something called The Trip, the rules about violence and how they changed, and how the practices became much darker after Chuck's wife died. Plus, how Sari's father finally left and how Synanon has impacted her and her own life.
That's right. Woo! That's what we're talking about. And before we talk about it, why am I covering my mouth? Before we talk about it, Megan, what is your cultiest thing of this week?
Okay, you know I'm following Danny Masterson, or however the fuck you say his last name. Let's look at it.
Do I know that?
Masterson. you know, the science.
Yeah, no, that's right.
The Scientologist guy from that 70s show. He asked yesterday for his trial to be postponed because the two people running for mayor right now, their names are Rick and Karen. Rick released a, like, mayor ad that made it look like Karen supported Scientology, and then Karen released an ad that was like, of course I don't support Scientology. Who would support Scientology? It's insane. And then Danny's lawyer was like, this is violating my client's rights because everybody's going to be so prejudiced against Scientology that he's not going to get a fair trial and we need to move it from October 11th to November 8th. Today, the judge said, no, we will not be doing that. We are going to start. And she said that Scientology evidence was relevant because it was important to the credibility of the three accusers and why they didn't come forward sooner.
They accused him of sexual assault, for context, right? These are rape allegations. Yeah.
Apologies. I feel like everybody's following it as close as I am. They're not. And she also said there is no basis to consider that Scientology evidence is so inflammatory that no jury could reach an impartial verdict. So he's up.
I just want to point out how you said Rick and Karen like it's a cute TV show.
Rick and Karen, you know, Rick and Care.
Rick Caruso and Karen Bass.
Yeah.
Rick Caruso is the billionaire that everyone, all the cool kids in LA hate. And Karen Bass is the alternative candidate who apparently is better.
Yay.
Clearly, I've done my research. No, I have. I like her. I like her. I do.
Well,
like her.
I'm on a first name basis. So, yeah, I'm good.
Listen, we're trying to avoid anti-abortion billionaires. That's what we're trying to do. So
good news.
Good news that he doesn't get to use that as an excuse.
Yeah.
To have his trial postponed.
Let's start this trial. He has been fucking around with it for so long. I am ready for him to face the music. Let's see what happens.
He's one of these guys who like everyone kind of knew about for a long time and nothing ever really happened until recently.
Yeah, everybody would just be like, stay away from him. And you'd be like, oh, okay.
It's crazy that there are still a handful of people like that I was going to come out about. I'm not going to name them here, but we all know.
I know.
We all know in L.A.
Move to L.A. Get the first scoop.
The Ladies Whisper Network.
Mm-hmm. What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
I feel really dumb because this is a historical thing that I actually really didn't know anything about. So clearly I have an interest in historical events because there are so many interesting ones, including some that we cover here. But history was my absolute worst subject in school because I think I just had shitty teachers and I don't know anything.
Yeah.
So I'm going to preface this by saying that. So I started reading the book, The Three Body Problem. Do you know about this book?
No.
It's a science fiction series, and it's incredible, and they're now making a Netflix series about it, but it's currently only in book form, and it explores the Cultural Revolution in China, which took place in the 60s and 70s. Yeah, 60s and 70s, through about 10 years. And holy shit, Megan. Do you know anything about this?
No, I have no idea.
Like, okay, so I knew that there was like the Red Scare, and I knew that Mao Zedong was a person who was relevant, and maybe there was some bad stuff. I didn't know anything about this. I'm just going to read from Wikipedia, and feel free to correct me if any of this is not historically accurate, but this is the general gist of what I have read so far. So its stated goal was to preserve Chinese communism by purging remnants of capitalist and traditional elements from Chinese society and to reimpose Mao Zedong thought as the dominant ideology. So what happened? I mean, I'm not going to be able to like get into the whole thing right now. It's so complicated and every region kind of experienced a different thing. But it turned into, there were all of these massacres that occurred. There was this really, really strong like anti-elitist sentiment, which in theory, you're like, yeah, sounds great. We don't like elitists, but it was like
French revolutionary type shit.
Yes. There were massacres. There were mass humiliations. People would be found to be, quote, counter-revolutionary and would just commit suicide because it was so terrifying what they would do to you.
Oh, my God. What
certain, you know, depending on where you were. Teachers were sent to labor camps. Students were like outing their teachers, like some witch trial shit. Like children were doing it to their parents. There was like, I guess, like a heavy, very strong student faction of this. Like, you know, young people, whatever, would like get into causes. And this just like happened to be this cause that people got into. There was even a region in which, I'm going to say it wrong, but it looks like Guangxi. There was a region in which mass cannibalism took place.
Oh, my God.
Not out of starvation, just out of like, you know, kind of making an example of people and like a political thing. Absolutely terrifying. I mean, that is the biggest cult I can think of. It says there were clashes between people. There wasn't just like, you know, I think it was the dynamics were extremely complicated, but schools were closed. Death toll claims vary widely, with estimates of those perishing during the revolution ranging from hundreds of thousands to millions.
Holy shit.
Millions were accused of being members of the five black categories, which were landlords, rich farmers, counter-revolutionaries, which anyone basically could be accused of being a counter-revolutionary if they weren't adhering really, really strictly to whatever the ideology was. Bad influencers, which again could be anything, and right-wingers. And academics and intellectuals, according to this Wikipedia article, but there are some citations here, were regarded as the stinking old ninth and were widely persecuted. Anyway, the three-body problem opens with kind of a scene from this era, which is just like absolutely fucking devastating. And I was reading it and I was like, wow, this is insane. And then I noticed that there were footnotes about like history. And I was like, wait, did this actually happen? I didn't know that this actually happened.
Wow.
I feel like I'm displaying my ignorance and probably saying something offensive. And again, I apologize if I am. But this was in the 60s and 70s. Like, this was not that long ago. So it's really, really interesting, especially because, like, you know, in theory, capitalism, yeah, bad thing. We don't want capitalism. But, like, it just goes to show any ideology that you have can be taken to the extreme and become so, so, so dangerous and scary. Anyway, all of this is to say, I would really love to have some like historical expert on to talk about this because, you know, I obviously want to get a more thorough, informed perspective on this like era of history. But it's absolutely Fascinating.
Send us an email to trustmepod@gmail.com if you know an expert.
I'm sure we'll be diving deeper into that very soon. So
wonderful.
Stay on the lookout. And in the meantime, let us talk to Sari. Welcome, Sari Crawford, to Trust Me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. You host a podcast that's out right now called The Sunshine Place, which is about Synanon, a drug rehabilitation cult that existed from the 50s until the 70s. This podcast is so good. I've only listened to a few episodes, but there's so much interesting audio. There's so many different people who are a part of it. It gets into the nitty gritty of the cult in such a detailed, fascinating way that I really hadn't heard before. You host it because your father was not only a member, but also a leader in Synanon, right?
Yeah, he was one of the original 12, actually. So he was there for the first 20 years of its existence. So he put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into that place.
So can you tell us about sort of the origins of Synanon and who Chuck was?
Yeah, great question. So it started out as Chuck, you know, being an alcoholic and looking for solutions for himself and people like himself that didn't end in jail or death, you know, or the alternatives that they had at the time for alcoholics and drug addicts. So he kind of created a little group in his apartment, and he was on unemployment. And, you know, my dad kind of joined that little group. And then they started getting facilities and things like that and building it up to what it was, a multi-million dollar rehab industry. And it really pioneered rehabilitation and therapy for drug addicts when there weren't any other options.
Yeah, so it was known kind of worldwide. Like every time I read about Synanon, I find these like old articles talking about how, I mean, you just said the word pioneering, so the word pioneering is in my head. I can't think of another one, but pioneering this program was, and how just like exciting and interesting. And it was known as a therapeutic tool. It was touted because it had the really high rate of curing addiction as opposed to the other programs that were out there. So it was offering what, at least at the time, appeared to be genuine benefits, right?
Yes. You know, the game, which turned into what's now called attack therapy, was actually pretty therapeutic. You could air out anything, really, except for threats of violence. That really was sort of based directly off the 12-step program and kind of helped morph what AA and NA are today.
So Chuck was in AA, correct? And then he started this after.
Yes, he went to some meetings of what was sort of the experimental start of AA, and then took a lot of those principles and created Synanon and sort of went off of that.
So how did your dad get involved exactly? Did Chuck just have this like little tiny group and your dad met him and liked him? Like, do you know how it all kind of began with him?
So my understanding is that, you know, my dad was a jazz musician and that got into heroin, and he went to L.A., try to make it as a jazz musician. And the heroin addiction got really bad. His first wife, he introduced the heroin, and she actually overdosed and passed away. And that's the mother of his son. Mm. So he was, you know, he carried a lot of guilt, and he knew he had to do something. You know, he had two small boys and he had to fix his life. So I think he just was searching for a place where he could belong and better himself and get clean and sober. And at that time, there really wasn't a lot of halfway houses and things like that, sober living facilities. And Chuck really ran with AA and created a way to soberly live with him in that apartment. From there, they wanted to open it up. So that's how he kind of entered in with Chuck.
That is the worst rock bottom ever. Your wife, who you introduced to the drug, dies. That's horrible. I mean, I can't imagine how rough that was for him. So over time, this group kind of grows, becomes super famous. Celebrities join, right? Like, because like it's like in LA, it's like in Santa Monica. So are there famous people involved? Can you remind me?
Yeah. So it wasn't right away, but as time went on and they started getting locations, they started throwing what were called Saturday night parties. And they were sober parties, but they were pretty much open to everyone. And it was a way to not only get donors to come so that people understood what was going on in the community and getting involved, And at this time, they hadn't quite opened up to lifestylers yet, but they would soon. And during the Saturday night parties, Lucille Ball came, Frank Sinatra came, so many celebrities came. Some of them donated, some of them got involved, and some of them stayed. Like Leonard Nimoy actually taught acting classes at the Santa Monica location.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Crazy. I mean, shit, I'd go.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I'm reading, it's like the first time people had hope, really, addicts, was this community. That's so interesting. Yeah, of course, it was like a cultural explosion in LA. And
yeah, and it's interesting, your dad was a jazz musician doing heroin. I feel like that was such a specific culture at that time, and there wouldn't be a lot of options for rehab yet that were effective anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
So what are some of the, in the beginning at least, obviously this thing evolves over time and gets darker, but what are some of the like original like beliefs and practices?
That's a great question. I wish I was there back then because it would have been wild to be there in the 60s, right? But, you know, the principles were really just two rules, you know, no violence and no threat to violence of any kind at all, period. And no drugs or alcohol, of course. And those really were the only two rules. And that was, you know, the culture there. Later on, they started adding things like the sitting on prayer and whatnot. But for a good almost 15 years, those were really the only principles of living there.
Mm. But people are living together on like a compound. Can you kind of describe what the like actual physicality of it is?
Great question. There were separate facilities, one in San Francisco, one was a ranch in Tamales Bay. So there was different types of living based on kind of what job you had in the community. But I've actually visited the Santa Monica location. It's now the Del Mar Hotel. It's set up like a hotel and they bought it that way. It was like a club. You know, imagine living in a big hotel and everybody kind of got a room. It wasn't co-ed. So if you had a husband or a partner or someone you were dating, they actually had separate rooms you could, quote unquote, rent out to, you know, be with your partner and have those visits, conjugal visits.
Wow.
But yeah, it was like living in a big hotel, but they had, you know, different floors. They had classrooms, they had mess halls, things like that. And it was kind of a wonderful place. And then in the main room, you know, it's a funny story because this kind of sums up Synanon very well. But they would get donated furniture because everything was donations, right? And when you walked in, there was big rooms, right? And this was at Seawall and Santa Monica as well. And inside was all mismatched furniture, right? And that was because everything was donated. So you'd have this great hall with just people smoking and chatting and all this different mismatched furniture, right? But somehow came together as one. And that's really representative of Synanon, all these different people that came together and learned to live as one.
Mm. Wow, that sounds really fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to go. It sounds like Melrose Place with sober people.
I've been telling my boyfriend how much I wish I had had the experience of like summer camp as a kid and how much I wish there was summer camp for adults or just like any kind of communal living, but where we're doing activities and that's like in the city. So it's not too removed. So that just sounds like a thing that I would definitely be into, even as someone who is not an addict. So, okay. Can you talk to us about the game a little bit more?
Yeah. What is it? Why?
So, the game, to my understanding, now this is a very complicated living, breathing sort of organism, you have to understand. But what it started out was, you know, group therapy, a way to air any and all of your grievances with others in the community so you could learn how to live together and get along together. But also, you know, talk about why you're an addict, sort of like AA, but more in depth, right? And it morphed into something more intense. Then it turned into what we would call today more attack therapy or tough love. It wasn't all like that, but it really became pretty wild. And you could, like I said, without violence or threats of violence, you could say anything to anybody. And they would actually broadcast it over their version of the radio, which is called The Wire. And it would be like, you know, ESPN, like, oh, what are we going to do today? It's Chuck versus Bill Crawford. And they would anticipate who was going to say what to whom. And,
oh, wow.
You know what I mean? It'd be this big thing and people would tune in and you could hear it. You know, you could be in San Francisco and listen to a game in Santa Monica and vice versa. So it really morphed into this crazy thing. And then as, you know, violence became part of the community, things got more intense in the game. It started being several days at a time. Sometimes that would be how they would break you. You'd go 72 hours locked in a room, no sleep, very little food. Maybe you got 2 hours here and there of sleep, but not enough to function. And you would take a very hard addict, right? And you would break him in a way that he would tell his story. And then all of a sudden he belonged to the community and the community accepted him. Unfortunately, some of that was turned against these people later on, but it really Chuck saw it as the only way to get into some of these very hardened criminals, you know, that have even committed murder. And how do you get through somebody like that? So that was the purpose of the game.
Interesting. So, I mean, first of all, classic page out of the cult playbook, which is have people divulge things to the group and then use it against them later and humiliate them in front of everyone. Like, these are just like age old tactics. But I've never heard of like taking a criminal or an addict who, you know, needs to be broken down for their own good, allegedly, and using that as kind of the way to get them to open up. It's like, I get the logic of it in theory, but of course that ends up being incredibly abusive and like essentially torture, psychological torture.
I mean, it sounds like it worked for a minute and then it just all went too far, interestingly.
Exactly. That's the way I would put it because, you know, many people will tell you, you know, it saved their lives. And I don't think they would say that lightly. You know, the first time in their life, they had an opportunity to really break down the deep parts of them and what they'd done wrong and be in a community at the time in the beginning that wouldn't judge them. You know, you could say there are, you know, hospitals and programs out there that do a similar thing today.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
I was reading about how they would do like role playing in terms of like, you know, my dad abused me as a kid, so we're going to role play that Chuck is my dad or whatever and then say the things to say to him, which is super interesting because like when you read The Body Keeps the Score, one of the things that they talk about, you know, overcoming trauma as one of the possible tools is role playing the figures from your childhood. Like, so there are these really interesting ideas here that like could be useful for people.
Yes, absolutely. And he did pioneer that in a way, but, you know, in a very intense way, because let's say an addict came in and Chuck was really big about, you know, Oedipus complex and things like that. And, you know, say, you're here because, you know, your dad molested you or something, right? And he would be their dad and play their dad, but sometimes in a very violating way, like, you know, I'm here, I molested you. And for some people, that was exactly what they needed. You know, nobody had ever made them talk about it and made them confront their abuser, and Chuck allowed them to do that. But for others, you know, who weren't ready to do that, it was more traumatic. So you get a sort of a mixed bag in people that will tell you that it helps and people that will tell you that it wasn't for them.
Well, right. It makes sense. Like, any program, if you're using a one-size-fits-all approach, you're going to have people who end up not being the right thing for and potentially re-traumatized. But especially when there's a leader who starts getting drunk on his power. So this is the thing that I find that I was maybe the most fascinated about learning this time, which is the trip. And I would love to hear a little bit more about what the trip was. I love that all of these sound like movies, by the way. We have the game. We have the trip. The trip. Go on.
So interestingly enough, here's where my dad comes in, because my dad really pioneered the trip. You know? And my dad was saying, we need to get out, we need to get away, we need to do team building just like you would in any other situation. We need to come together, right? And the trip was a way for people to get out of the community, get out of themselves, see something new, be somewhere new. And they would have like special games on the trip and things like that. But it really was about team building. They'd go skiing and they learned how to work together. And you could say that very much is a pillar in rehabilitation now and just, you know, in any kind of communal society. But he really put it together, all those trips, and kind of set them up. And you'd also have like cross location trips. So someone in San Francisco could sign up and they would fly them down to Santa Monica and then bus them into the facility. And then you would meet new people and have new exciting games because you would be in a new environment. But everybody knew the rules because it was still synagogue.
And he would talk about peak experiences. I guess he'd had a very important for him peak experience on LSD, and now in this sort of drug-free initially environment, he wanted to recreate that peak experience but without the drugs, right? So it became this like very ritualistic, like spiritual, immersive thing that people would do to kind of generate that heightened experience. Do you remember some of the details of that?
So yeah, so as we know now, a lot of addicts sometimes will replace one addiction with another because you're always searching for the next high, right? You're always trying to search for, you know, they say your first high. Chuck's peak experience with LSD, that was one of the first times he took LSD, and he was searching for that kind of feeling again. So all of these rituals and, you know, sleep deprivation, things like that, we're trying to get your brain to have this almost like a high, but being sober or clean. And so he was always searching for the way to do that and adding things. And as lifestylers came on, you know, they liked it too because, you know, they had never done drugs, but they were experiencing their own high. You know, we've got endorphins, you know, running around, dopamine running around. And that really was the idea of the peak experience, having like the witching hour at midnight, waking people up and getting them in ritual. There's something psychological about it. It really makes you feel a part of something. And that's what he was after.
Yeah, absolutely. Creating a heightened emotional experience is such a smart way to kind of bond people to your group and make them want to keep returning, because that's such an exciting feeling. And it feels like there is something genuinely spiritual going on, even if it is just like in some groups, it's hours of meditation on end. And in some groups, it's an intensive, whatever, staring at something while someone shines a flashlight on your eyes and you think it's God, whatever it is. Like, it tends to be like that heightened thing really keeps people feeling like the group is this meaningful, powerful, spiritual thing for them.
Yeah.
So was your dad a leader just kind of by default because he was there for so long?
I would say so. I mean, a lot of people looked up to him. He was never one to want to be a leader. He never was that kind of person, but he was given a task to do and he did it well. He was very literate. He was college educated. You know, he wasn't your typical heroin addict, you know, and he got funding. You know, he did all sorts of things. And my understanding is that he pretty much was mostly universally loved in Synanon because, you know, he's a laid back guy. I remember him being a laid back guy. But yeah, I would consider him a leader. I don't think Synanon would have been able to get its funding and a lot of the programs that it did without him. And people did recognize that. And Chuck needed him in a circle for a long time because he was so intelligent in what he did. And Chuck was a smart guy, but he was the bronze of the operation, and my dad was sort of behind the scenes, and he was the brains of the operation.
So at what point does the rule about nonviolence change?
So that was a gradual change around 1976. It started into 1977, and the peak of it really got into 1978. You know, that was the peak of the violence. But it wasn't like an overnight thing. You know, everybody says, oh, it's a cult, I would never do that. But you don't know it. You're in it. It's, you know, like the frog in the pot. As you increase the temperature very slowly, and then the frog doesn't feel how hot it gets and dies. But yeah, it was first Chuck would say over the wire, he would just experiment, you know, what do you guys think about so-and-so, he's getting knocked around, you know, started with the kids, you know, knock them on their ass if they complain. and started with the kids. And as the kids got knocked around, you know, the adults started saying, well, we could use that for some of our participants, you know, and it slowly snowballed.
So over time, Chuck starts getting more into this idea of violence. So there was a group called the Imperial Marines. Can you talk about what they were?
So my understanding of the Imperial Marines was that it started because Chuck really felt like the community needed protection. You know, you're talking about a group of addicts. He felt like if something happened to them, who was he going to call? I mean, there were sheriffs in his pocket, but he needed to protect his own, and nobody was going to care about a bunch of addicts if people were violating them. And then as people started trying to get their kids out of the community and things like that, Chuck got more and more paranoid. So the Imperial Marines were trained as sort of security. And then as time went on, became more offensive. And then he started, you know, as Chuck started drinking again, you know, would say, okay, you know, well, if somebody comes to Synanon and, you know, beat them up so they don't come back, you know, send them a message. And the Imperial Marines changed from security to really carrying out a lot of Chuck's bidding. And Chuck never said, go break so-and-so's legs. You know, but he would say, so-and-so is really getting out of line. Such a shame. Or if this person's coming on our property, I can't stand it. Someone should be teaching him a lesson. And that was very much for the Imperial Marines to go carry out his bidding.
Basically, they start threatening people. They're kind of getting a little bit more violent. Mm-hmm. You know, this trajectory is, again, very classic, where it's like guy starts a group. He starts loving having all of these followers and loving this power. Mm-hmm. People start getting a little bit wary of the group. Some people start leaving. Some people start saying it's a cult.
Yeah.
He starts jealously guarding his power. And then that's when things typically, once that paranoia begins, that's when things typically tend to start getting a little bit more violent.
Yeah.
And in this case, yeah, he totally follows that, once again, follows that playbook to a T. So after Chuck's wife dies, he gets a new partner. And can you tell us what happened after that?
Great question. Well, things went to shit, to say it bluntly. But yeah, you know, he was depressed. Betty, you know, my mom talks about Betty, how she was, you know, his wife Betty was such a light in Synanon. She really balanced Chuck, from my understanding. And she helped keep him sober, in the sense that she stayed sober with him. She encouraged him to keep going, encouraged him to be sober, to be present, to take care of his flock, so to speak. If he would get out of line or something, she'd kind of calm him down. And she really was the yin to his yang. And when she died, and in such a horrible way to watch her suffer and die, Chuck felt like, well, if he couldn't be with his loved one, almost nobody could. Of course, he didn't frame it that way. But he really wanted, in the back of his mind, for people to kind of feel the pain he was in, and, you know, started experimenting with these relationships. But Betty was wonderful. She really was Synanon, even though Chuck Diedrich is Synanon, she really was behind the scenes for many years as a pillar of what Synanon used to be.
Was that kind of the turning point when things started to get dark, or did it start before that?
Yes, absolutely. I would say almost everybody in the community that I have spoken with will say that Betty's death directly affected Chuck's sobriety, which then directly affected the community, because it's like an addict leading an addict, you know? And as soon as she died, he started drinking again. And how is he going to tell all these addicts that are looking for sobriety how to live if he can't be sober? And the community totally changed. There's a poem, I believe it's called The Hangman, and it's like, you know, they came for my neighbor, I said nothing. They came for my friend, I said nothing. Then they came for me, and nobody said anything. There was nobody left to say anything. And that's similar to how it was in the community. He didn't just start drinking and tell everybody to drink. He actually went to Italy for a little bit, took his cronies, went off the grid, took a break, and that's where he started binge drinking with his closest confidant. And then slowly, as the big wigs in Synanon, my father had left by now, so my father was not there drinking with him, but slowly as the big leaders of the community started binge drinking with him, and they all came back to Synanon, they started seeing them drinking, slowly the addicts and lifestylers got on board. So it was just very, very gradual. And then, you know, as you see, oh, so-and-so is doing it. Oh, Chuck's doing it. Oh, I can do it. And it sort of wasn't just like, okay, everybody can drink now. It wasn't really like an announcement. It was just, he's doing it. Everybody's going to do it.
And I can imagine there being a culture where it's like, oh, well, maybe we've defeated our alcoholism or our addiction because we have this community now. We have this sort of guiding force in our lives. So I can imagine it not seeming the same as if you were to start drinking just like on your own outside the group and there being a way to justify that.
Yeah, for sure. The community was something different. They had lifestylers in it. It wasn't just like a rehab community and that's it. It was something different. It was just a way for people to live together and take care of each other. And I think he said, you know, well, you know, forget all the addiction stuff. We're really more about living together and taking care of each other. And that's the most important thing. And unfortunately, people died. People had hep C and they drank themselves to death. You know, I think it influenced my father as well. He started drinking again as well. So yeah, it had a major impact on the community and a very serious one.
I mean, and it also is very much in line with, you know, typically cult leaders will just change their message out of nowhere. And often they'll do it frequently and completely the opposite of the thing they said last week. And the point is that by that point, their followers are so indoctrinated and are so looking to them for their answers that the actual content of the message doesn't really matter because their autonomy has been taken away and their entire belief system is based on following this person. So from the outside, it's like, what? You start to write, but on the inside, you're like, oh, the person who knows all of the things is doing this thing. So I follow them. So what am I supposed to do?
Absolutely. And it's not just the person. It's, you know, my best friend is here. My wife is here. My children are here. Mm-hmm. You know, what would I do if I left? Synanon, you know, for many people, Synanon saved their lives. You have to understand that. And what do you do when a lifestyle or a quote unquote cult actually literally saved your life? And although it was, you know, became something scary, and I'm not trying to justify people's choices in staying or participating in the violence, I can see how somebody could say, well, I would be dead if Synanon wasn't here. So anything goes.
I want to rewind a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the sterilizations and when and how that happened.
So that started around the time that the violence started, around 76, 77. And my understanding, again, it was very gradual. You know, they had the school for kids. And then they would have a branch that they created called the Punk Squad, where the troubled children, the especially troubled children, would be put into. And it was like boot camp. You know, they would make them run 5 miles every morning from the time they were 6 years old. They'd have to make hospital corners in their bed. They'd bounce a quarter or a nickel off of the corners of the bed. Very strict. And then they started kind of beating up these kids as punishment. Very, you know, you could say unruly kids, but we know that being violent with them is not going to help them. We know that now. So started around then. And then from there, they said, well, we got all these unruly kids. And, you know, how are we going to feed them? How are we going to fund them? More and more people are coming, lifestylers bringing their children. What are we going to do? So Chuck said, you know what? No more kids. No more kids. You can't have your kids sitting on. You can't put them in the school. And the best way to do that is for men to get vasectomies and for women to have abortions. And then you don't even have to worry about it because there just won't be kids, right? And that's how it started. And people started volunteering to get these vasectomies and volunteering to get these abortions. And the undertone was, do it or you're out. And people already had their kids in the school. They were getting clean for the first time in their life. They were thriving. And, you know, with a snip here and there. And nobody saw it as a problem because everybody was like, you know, some addicts, you know, volunteering to get sterilized. Who cares, you know? Yeah, but it got pretty intense and scary all the way down to, you know, the 18-year-olds. And my father had one too, and he regretted it as well because we left and him and my mom were married and now they had a whole life to face and, you know, he was sterile. And it really changed the course of a lot of people's lives, and some people didn't feel they had a choice.
Oh, that's so horrible. So your mom and dad met in the group?
Yeah. So my dad was actually married to his third wife when he met my mom. He was kind of a playboy. That was always him. He was a ladies' man. But yeah, they met in Sinanon, and my dad changed partners, so to speak. And my mom and dad got married in the Renaissance wedding, which was a wedding of 75 couples, a mass wedding on the beach. And at the time, it was just this revolutionary thing to get married with all of your friends. So yeah, that's how they met.
Wow. And so that was when Chuck decided that because he had gotten a new partner, everyone else also needed to get a new partner?
That was a little beforehand. I used the term loosely, but no, they weren't required to change partners at that time. My dad just really fell in love with my mom.
He just did.
Yeah. And then later on, they were kind of forced to separate and change partners. And my mom, with her and her partner, they spent the night crying and they didn't actually have sex because they both loved their spouse. But no, that was a little bit beforehand. The Renaissance wedding was still in what many people would consider good times of Sinanon.
Oh, wow. Okay. So people were with people they wanted to be with for that. Okay. In that case, that sounds super fun.
Yeah. People dressed up. It was a great time.
But right. So then later, then he's like, everyone needs to be with someone new because if I'm in pain, you all also have to be in pain, basically.
Yeah.
So at that point, like, he's controlling so much about people's lives. He's controlling who they're with. He's controlling whether they have children. Were there other things? What else was under the control of Chuck and Sinanon in general?
Everything. I mean, every facet of your life, down to sex. You know, how you look, people shaved their heads.
Right.
How you acted, how your children were taught and raised, who you could be with, and when you could be with them. That wasn't always like that. You know what I mean? Nobody just joined a quote-unquote cult. It wasn't always like that. But yes, it went all the way down to, you know, what you could eat and who you could date and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a thing that happens over time. If you were to enter a group and someone was like, welcome, I'm going to control every single thing in your life. Mm-hmm. As soon as they got in, nobody would join. Nobody would stay, right? Like, that is a little bit more here and then a little bit more here and then a little bit more there until finally you have no identity left and no autonomy whatsoever.
And what you could wear, denim overalls were the thing, men and women, especially on the ranch in Tomales Bay. And actually, to the day my dad died, he usually always wore denim overalls.
Wow.
So, you know, that was sort of the uniform of Sinanon in a way, or became.
I didn't know that. Okay, now I'm looking at pictures. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Was there an explanation for that, or is it just kind of like what Chuck liked?
There might be. I don't know. You know, I'm learning a lot myself, but, you know, I think, you know, it was just part of being the workforce. You know, it showed that you were a hardworking individual that was part of a community and part of something larger than yourself. And they literally built Sinanon from the ground up.
Wow. I mean, in particular, the way that the kids were treated is something that is sad to hear about. We had Mikkel Jolet on here and the abuse of the children. I'm sure obviously no one realized that was what it was at that time. But there were a lot of unfortunate things that eventually over time began to happen. And so can you tell us about how finally your dad was over it and got out of there?
So my dad, you know, he'd kind of been thinking about leaving. My mom wanted to leave. My mom wanted to leave as soon as the violence started, but my dad had built this place from the ground up. He had spent every waking moment of the last 20 years of his life, you know, getting funding for Sinanon, helping better the school, having a better education for the children. He built playgrounds for the children. He watched it go from 12 people in an apartment to millions of dollars in assets and airstrip. I mean, you know, I can just imagine. And he went from somebody who was on the street, a heroin addict, nobody cared about, to being the leader of thousands of people, you know, one of the leaders. And I could see that he really thought he could convince Chuck to get back on track. He really, really did. And then eventually he did the year-end report for 1977. So this was very early 1978. And he saw all the violence and all the problems. And he finally said, you know, to my mom, we got to get out of here. And he wrote her a letter and said, I'm finally ready to go, you know. And they threw him out and they really you know, did a number on him, and he went to the desk and he said, I built this place. I built this place. And they, you know, threw him out with absolutely nothing. Mm. And Chuck said over the wire, so long, kid. And that was 20 years of his life.
Wow. And was he a target after he left?
He was in danger. He was absolutely harassed. But yeah, we would have guns in every room. I remember one time growing up, you know, he'd always look over his shoulder, and I was out feeding the chickens with him. And, you know, we had this little property. They didn't have much money, but we had this little property. We had chickens and a garden, things like that. And like this old truck pulls up, and could have been nothing, but he says, run as fast as you can to the house. And it was always things like that. And, you know, they would call him in the middle of the night. And whether or not they were serious about hurting him, you know, they had already hurt other people. And what they did to the man was horrible. I really think that I really wish they would have left him alone. But, you know, that's what happens when you bring violence into a community.
Yeah, people who left, I mean, many people experienced threats and violence after they left, which just goes to show you how far it had gone off track from what it was originally supposed to be.
Yeah.
So how much of this did you know about when you were growing up?
Only the good parts. I was raised by the Synanon community, you know, a lot of people, Miriam Bordette, John Sloane, Sherry McLendon, the Olins. I mean, so many people gathered around eventually. And, you know, I got to hear all the stories of Synanon. And for the most part, I only knew the positives. I really got this idea that it was pretty much this utopia that they had been in. And they didn't really talk a lot about the bad stuff. I really had to do my own research when I entered high school and when I started learning about Synanon as a whole. And I don't think they were naive in not understanding where Synanon went, but I think they were, especially my dad, was very good about understanding that there was the Synanon as it was and the Synanon as it became. And there were two totally, completely separate mindsets, separate communities, separate things, and separate leaders, if you could think, you know, the sort of Jekyll and Hyde personalities of Chuck. So when he talked about Synanon, he talked about Synanon as it was. So we didn't get into Synanon as it became, but to understand the community as a whole, you have to understand that it's two pieces to a puzzle.
How do you think that the experience overall and the experience of leaving impacted your dad?
That was horrible. I think it broke the man. I really think it broke the man. He spent 20 years sober and he didn't have a job. He didn't have a resume. He didn't have, you know, he couldn't call Chuck for a letter of recommendation after 20 years of service. Same thing with my mom. They never had any money. So my dad went from leading thousands of people and getting millions of dollars of funding, doing all these amazing things for the community, to driving a cab, and he actually got his throat slit in the cab. You know what I mean? And just taking rock bottom jobs, trying to survive. And he worked a blue collar job until the day he died at 75. He didn't retire or anything because he was just trying to make money. And it really broke him. And he did relapse from sobriety later on. I can't blame all his choices on Synanon, but I can say it really did break the man psychologically. And on top of that, he didn't feel like he could be very public about it because of the threat.
Oh, I cannot imagine being cut off from this life, this only thing you've known for that many years, your entire community, what probably feels like your family, like your support system, your source of income, and, you know, like everything, especially coming out and not having money. Like, there are people who come out of cults and they have access to resources to help them. And then there are way more people that don't have anything. And I just like feel so sad for people who have that experience, which was basically the experience that my mom had as well, where like, you don't have a new support system. You don't have any resources. You don't know what to do now to make your life feel good again, you know, like that can just be such a challenge.
Yeah. And his friends would say, you know, he never really talked bad about Sinanon. But, you know, why would he? I mean, he's surrounded by people that left before the violence because he didn't surround himself with people after the violence. And, you know, to them, it was night and day. It was a different type of Sinanon. So why would he, you know, want to talk about those times? He wanted to talk about the good times. But furthermore, his daughters, Naomi and Rebecca, were still in Sinanon. And that weighed heavily on him because he couldn't really go against Sinanon. He couldn't really speak out. He did wear like some shirts and a hat that would have the logo of Sinanon with, you know, a line through it, of course. But you can imagine he has two young children in there, and all he wants to do is see those children. He loved his girls all the way to the end. He loved his girls. And that put him in a very difficult position because he needed to see those girls, and that was priority number one.
Wow, I didn't know that part. Yeah, I mean, that's like unimaginably difficult. Because at least when you leave a cult and you don't have people left in it, you can find a way to process that experience and speak out about it. And that's really healing for a lot of people. But when you don't even have that, like that is, yeah, that's incredibly difficult. How do you think Sinanon has impacted your life? I mean, it sounds like you grew up around a lot of people who had really beautiful experiences with it. But, you know, obviously your dad was very impacted. But how do you kind of think of Sinanon now?
I like to think of it how my dad thought of it, as two sort of different Sinanons, and recognize Sinanon for what it was and for what it became. Just like the two sort of different communities, it has impacted me in both good and bad ways. The bad, of course, being that my family always felt they needed to look over their shoulder. You know, my dad had a lot of trauma from leaving the way he did, which as a child you can kind of pick up on, from living in poverty, basically. You know, we weren't on the street, but, you know, we had a very difficult time. But the good things were, you know, not everybody has this community that helps raise them and love them. And you know, I've had many surgeries, and there were people in Sinanon that stepped up and let us stay with them while I was, you know, having surgeries in California. You know, some of the teachings in the Sinanon prayer, like to understand rather than to be understood, you know, things like that, to live with people respectfully and kindly. You know, another thing would be, you know, the troubled teen industry. I wasn't the best kid. And I think my mom kind of thought maybe something structured like Sinanon school would be good for me. It was not. But then again, you know, what these programs tell parents is very different than what they actually are. So I don't blame it on her. But I think she was always kind of looking for that next Sinanon, looking for that next utopia, not only for her, but for myself. And, you know, sometimes it was good and sometimes it was back in that isolated cult sort of thinking.
I imagine if I went through an experience like the first part of Sinanon, I would be trying to recreate it for the rest of my life. Like,
absolutely.
It must be such a high... Like, I remember there was that one study about that one town, I think maybe it's in Greece, where people lived the longest of anywhere, and they were hypothesizing, oh, maybe it's the diet, maybe it's this. And ultimately, the hypothesis that they landed on was just like, is the community. It's so communal. Like, community keeps us alive. It keeps our stress levels down. It helps us feel connected and gives us meaning, you know, and to have it in such a, you know, meaningful way and then not get that anymore, then it gets sort of turns into this other thing. Like, that would be so hard. I would just always be trying to have that experience again.
We were talking about that peak experience, and I think especially for my mom, you know, was always searching for that. And actually, one of the jobs they did get coming out of Sinanon was they helped run a school for troubled teens, not in the punk squad military boot camp way, but in the way that Sinanon started and the school started, and brought many of the teachings with them to try to help those kids. So yeah, always looking for that peak experience.
Boy, do I get that. I'm looking for a peak experience myself.
I know, right? I don't blame one bit.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that we didn't touch on, or, you know, any final thoughts that you have?
Just that I don't think anybody will understand Synanon fully. I think it was not just a cult, and it was not just a utopia. It was everything in between. It was many people, many faces, many experiences. And I want the listeners to know that when they think of Synanon, think of a living, breathing community. Because Synanon officially ended in 1991 when the facility shut down. But Synanon is a state of mind. And as long as these community members are working with each other, visiting each other, helping each other, you know, that's what Synanon's about. And to label it just one way or another would be a disservice to these people and to the community. We definitely don't want it to be violent. We definitely don't want to justify what Synanon did and what it became. But that's just a very small piece of the story.
I love that you are the one hosting this podcast, because I feel like you can speak to so much of the good things about the community that you kind of were able to experience as a kid. I think that that's very cool, and you do a great job.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So tell us where we can listen and what it's called.
So podcast is The Sunshine Place. You can listen on Apple, Spotify, and Audible.
Awesome. And are you on social media?
I am. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and TikTok under Sari Crawford.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been amazing.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, since we have already done a Synanon episode, we do know that you would join Synanon. And I probably would.
We do know that, yes.
Probably would too. So I just like, I'm just going to comment on how it's interesting. I feel like there have been a number of cult leaders that we have seen in our various interviews who are actually like not that controlling or like not that violent, or sometimes not at all, until after their partner dies, which I think is super interesting, because it's like, you guys, you could just go to therapy instead of turning your cult into a violent organization. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like a meme. Like, on one side, process your emotions. On the other side, start a violent cult. And it's definitely easier to start a cult. No, I mean, I'm not even kidding. So I get it. But yeah, people.
Is that true? Do we,
if you are a person who struggles with narcissism, I imagine it is much easier to be in control than to try to be vulnerable.
Struggles with narcissism is an interesting way to put it. Because who knows, on the spectrum of narcissism, like, maybe you're not the violent kind, and until something happens that you're like unable to deal with because it makes you feel so vulnerable, and then you become the violent kind.
Interesting. We should like try to find a stat on that. I mean, I probably won't be doing that, but maybe we could figure it out.
On which specific
thing? How many people go more extreme after their partner dies?
Yeah, it's like either when a bunch of people leave the group, like that tends to be when they start to get really paranoid and controlling, or yeah, like after someone really important to them dies, which is so interesting because it's like where even they are just little kids who just don't want to be abandoned, but they just act out in really, really bad ways.
We're all in the same boat.
Except some of them are in a much worse.
And some of them are crashing them on purpose.
And so, yeah, some of them are really bad captains.
Thanks for listening this week, guys. As always, we can't wait to see you again next week. And remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever, ever
trust me.
Trust me.
Bye. Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.